WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last night, President Bush presented his case for going to war with Iraq if Saddam Hussein refuses to disarm. Iraq has something we don't want it to have, weapons of mass destruction. But it also has something that is very valuable, oil. And war with Iraq could change the economics and politics of oil for a long time to come. My guest Daniel Yergin won a Pulitzer Prize for his 1991 book about the history of oil, The Prize, The Epic Quest for Oil, Money, and Power. Yergin co-wrote the book Commanding Heights about the global economy and the economic history of the 20th century. He also co-produced the PBS adaptation, which is now out on video and DVD. Yergin is chair of Cambridge Energy Research Associates. I asked him how much oil Iraq is sitting on.
If you look at what's in the ground, what's called proven reserves, Iraq is actually the second largest. The only country with larger proven reserves at this point happens to be its neighbor, Saudi Arabia. And there's long been a view, because Iraq has been kind of in an isolation booth, not just for 10 years, but for 20 years or more, that in fact those reserves could be larger and that Iraq could be an even more major source of oil. But the ironic thing is that Iraq has over the last, particularly last year, but over the last several years, has really marginalized itself as an oil player. And just kind of two sets of numbers. When Iraq took the world by surprise and invaded Kuwait in August of 1990, suddenly overnight the world needed to replace 5 million barrels a day of Iraqi and Kuwaiti exports. Today, Iraq's exports are down around 1 million barrels a day because it's been fighting with the United Nations over the oil for food program. It has periodically declared its own embargoes and cut off its supplies, and it's put extra charges on it on price that have caused people to flee. So Iraq, ironically, is not a huge exporter today, and that means that as long as if there are hostilities and they don't spread to neighboring countries, there's enough capacity elsewhere to more than make up for Iraqi supplies.
So if Iraq is under attack and no oil is being pumped from there, that won't affect supplies. But
not, you know, there. But what you'd certainly see, you know, some of that is already, by the way, in the oil price. There's a kind of a fear premium. You know, if the price is around $30, $3, $4 of that price reflects anxiety about what's going to happen. And probably if hostilities start, that price goes up further until the market sort of looks around and says, oh, well, there's other supplies, this is okay. And then the price comes down, which is really what happened, you know, the day the war began in 1991 to eject Iraq from Kuwait. The price, instead of going up, went down.
For people who suspect that oil has something to do with our plans in Iraq, they often suspect that even more because President Bush, President Bush's father, and Vice President Dick Cheney are all from oil business backgrounds. Do you think that might figure into it at all?
Well, it certainly, you know, you hear that all the time, and I think it's clear that they know the business, but I think there's this view of a monolithic oil business, and one of the things you get if you read the prize is you realize there's so many different elements of it, often competing. Vice President Cheney ran an oil services and construction company, a large one for about 4 years, but essentially what he is been a professional politician, a public servant. President George W. Bush, you know, it's often said he comes from big oil, but actually the truth of it is he came from little oil. He had was involved with a small oil company, he more or less failed at that business. And, you know, he proved to be a success, actually, during the years he spent in the baseball business. So I don't think that these people are sitting there thinking somehow this is 1927 or 1954 and, you know, we're doing all of this for big oil. I think the other thing to note is that a lot of big oil is no longer American. Four out of seven of the major oil companies in the world are actually European, not American.
I think a lot of countries are trying to figure out what to bet on. Should they bet that Saddam Hussein is going to stay in power and therefore try to be on his side so that they could get oil benefits, or should they bet that he's going to be overthrown? Let's look specifically at a couple of countries like Russia and France, which have contracts with Iraq now. Tell us a little bit about what those contracts are.
Right. France, over the years, have been closer to Iraq than many other European Western countries, and has done a lot of business with Iraq. And the French national, well, it's no longer national. There's a French super major, as it's called, that reflected a merger of the two companies, has these contracts to develop two very large oil fields in Iraq. And one of the things you have to understand that there are these huge oil fields that have just been sitting there since 1970. They haven't been developed or very marginally developed. But the French government has never signed off on the treaty because of the UN sanctions. So the company is sitting there with these two contracts that are not, that are kind of in principle, that have been initialed, but are not actually in effect, and they're not doing any work there. And they would only do work when UN sanctions are raised one way or another. So the French are, they have a preferred position, you might say, but it's not in effect, and they're not spending money, they're not drilling for oil, they're not shipping oil out of the country. So the French seem to be very keen. I mean, what's sort of very central for them is that whatever happens is done through a UN framework, through the framework of the Security Council, where they're a permanent member. But the French are, they're kind of one of the great swing countries here in terms of which way do they go? Do they support a UN resolution? And of course, and part of the game right now is what kind of UN resolution comes out of this. But they may be thinking that as long as Saddam is there, they're going to have these contracts in principle and never be able to do anything with them.
On the other hand, if Saddam Hussein is overthrown, will their contracts with Iraq be honored?
Yeah, and that's where a lot of kind of action is right now, is what's going to happen. Of course, Terry, the way, let's stop and visualize for a second and say that there is a regime change and a new regime comes in. Well, the first problem that regime's going to have is kind of establishing its legitimacy, establishing its control. It's not the same situation of Afghanistan, but, that's not going to happen overnight. Then it says, okay, we have, unlike Afghanistan, which has precious little to sell into the world economy except, drugs and things like that, we can earn a living. We can make $40, $50 million a day selling oil. So this is our precious resource. They're going to be pretty nationalistic, and they're going to say, I don't think there are going to be any sweetheart deals, any favoritism. They're going to drive the kind of tough bargain that represents the sort of state of the the exploration business. What are the nature of the deals that people make? And, they're going to get 85 or 90% of the revenues. But that probably takes maybe a year to sort out the politics, to work out the arrangements. Then it takes a couple of years to restore the Iraqi oil industry to where it was before it can really get on an expansion course. So that's the kind of process of negotiation. Then, the companies that have positions there, like the French and the Russian and the others, will say, well, our deal really wasn't with Saddam Hussein or his regime. Our deal was with the sovereign state of Iraq. So we have a preferred position here, and our position should be reserved. The new government will probably say, maybe yes, maybe no, and negotiate with them. I mean, I think the key question for Iraq is whether it is a stable political system with a new regime, because Iraq needs a lot of investment in its oil industry. It's really been deteriorating under Saddam, and its key thing, its capacity, has declined by something like 20 or 25% in the last 10 years, its ability to produce. So it needs a lot of investment, but it's not going to get investment from international companies unless they figure there's going to be stability of contracts, stability of government, that, that things aren't going to become chaotic. So I think if Iraq gets to a relatively democratic, well-grounded political system, it probably means that more investment will come into the country faster, and that Iraq will become a bigger producer and a bigger exporter sooner.
Let's look at Russia. Iraq owes Russia $8 billion in debt, and this is money that they have owed Russia since before the Gulf War. Russia's very worried about getting the $8 billion yeah. back. What kind of deals does Russia have with Iraq?
The Russians, as you say, are owed about $8 billion by the Iraqi regime. They're not getting paid. They don't know when or if they'll get paid. Iraq altogether, I think, owes something like $140 billion. So there are a lot of people in line to get paid there who are not getting paid. Russia has operated in Iraq, and Russian equipment is used there. There's been a relationship between the old Soviet oil industry and the Iraqi industry. Russian so-called oil service companies, which provide technology, are active there. And then you have these kind of $40 billion deals, you know, that are sort of announced. But, you know, whenever you hear people announce $40 billion deals, you know, there's a lot of air in there. And it's very vague as to what's there or not there. But so that's on the column of Russia being concerned about its present position. It, too, has companies that have significant contracts also, which are not being implemented because of U.N. sanctions.
My guest is Daniel Yergin, author of the book The Prize, The Epic Quest for Oil, Money, and Power. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about Iraq and oil. My guest is Daniel Yergin, author of Commanding Heights and the Pulitzer Prize-winning book about oil, The Prize. Well, talk a little bit about Saudi Arabia and what the Saudis see as in their best interest. Now, by the Saudis, I guess I mean the Saudi family.
Right. I think the Saudis are, are very concerned about hostilities and conflict in the region and what might follow from that. That's one set of concerns. They've not exactly been jumping up and down saying, they want to get on this team. They've been standing off from it, reflecting their assessment of what's happening in their own public opinion and politics and so forth. I think they're also have gotten accustomed to Iraq being kind of this sort of rather minor, in relative terms, maverick in the oil business, and don't really know what it would be like if Iraq suddenly, over a period of a few years, became a major player. But between being a major player and being on the same level of Saudi Arabia is still a pretty big gap. But it would change the balance within OPEC, and it would change the balance in the region.
With the political problems that we're having in the Gulf area and with the terrorist threat that we face since September 11th, it seems the Bush administration has become even more interested in cultivating oil from other parts of the world. And those other parts include Russia, Central Asia, Africa. Let's look at Russia for a second. What's happening there with oil cultivation, and how is that affecting our relationship with Russia?
There is a very dramatic turnaround going on now between the United States and Russia. There was a large U.S.-Russian oil and gas summit that was held in Houston last week, which showed that things are happening, but not... But there's still a lot of things to be worked out because, one of the really interesting features is you're seeing these kind of emergence of these Russian Rockefellers, these Russian oil companies that are saying, well, we don't really necessarily need a lot of investment. And so there's a lot of discussion about what is and isn't possible. But one of the things that has hit me is that the Russians have decided that if they're going to be a real force in the world oil market, that Russia needs to be a significant oil exporter to the United States. And a year ago, I would have thought that's not very likely or practical. But today, I think it's, there's a fair chance that a few years from now, we'll be importing some important part of our oil from Russia. And there was this, a tanker of Russian oil arrived in Houston on July 4th. And the latest purchase of oil going into our Strategic Petroleum Reserve is coming from Russia. So that's pretty strong symbolism. And, and what does it symbolize? It symbolizes diversification, less reliance on the Middle East, and that Russia will be playing a bigger role than one might have thought even a few years ago.
Now, former Soviet republics in Central Asia, like Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan, are sources of oil. But to get them, pipelines would be needed to be created through Central Asia. So what are some of the politics now surrounding Central Asia and getting the oil out of there? And what kind of new political alliances are we trying to create to make those pipelines possible?
Yes. You're right. Central Asia is a real kind of hotspot. And this is, you know, the past and the future come together. One of the things when I was writing the prize that I was most amazed to discover is that at the beginning of the 20th century, the world's largest source of oil for a few years was none other than Baku in Azerbaijan. And here we are again. I think there were kind of exaggerated views that these countries were a new Middle East, and to the best of current knowledge, they're not. But they're significant new sources of oil. But you point to a very essential fact that this oil is basically landlocked. You can't just bring up a supertanker and fill her up and sail off. And so pipelines and pipeline politics have been on the table now for 6 or 7 years.
I think the United States is hoping that Africa will become an increasingly good source of oil for the United States. What are some of the countries we're looking at there now, hoping to cultivate for oil?
Well, the countries, of course, Nigeria is already a major producer and exporter of oil, and indeed a member of OPEC. But Angola is a very large source of oil, Equatorial, Guinea, and there are several other countries that basically that sort of area of West Africa is considered very prolific, and it too is a real hotspot. And, you know, a lot of activity is going on there. And if you think about, you know, it's sort of, you have to sometimes stand back and look at it. Right now, for instance, one of the major sources of oil in the world today is the North Sea between Britain and Norway, and realizing that West Africa will soon exceed the North Sea as a source. And that means, you know, very significant revenues flowing into those countries.
Now, you've pointed out that getting oil from Africa is fairly logistically easy, but it's very politically complex.
Yes, that everywhere you look in the world, there are these trade-offs. In case of Africa, you can load a tanker offshore, and you don't have to worry about building 2,000-mile pipelines or 1,500-mile pipelines. But you do have to worry, of course, that so many of these countries suffer from great poverty. They suffer from civil war, ethnic conflict, disease, kind of instability in their governments. And of course, corruption's a big issue right through the region. So those are kind of the obstacles to development. And then there's a kind of technical question, is that a lot of gas gets produced with this oil, and if you can harness that gas and create a kind of regional pipeline network, you could do a lot to create opportunities for people to raise their standard of living. So there, the obstacles are not geological or technical, but they're really political and social.
Now, a French oil tanker was blown up in Yemen. It's unclear yet whether this was a terrorist attack or an accident. If it proves to be a terrorist attack, what significance do you think that would have?
If it proves to be a terrorist attack, then I think it would kind of affect the tilt of France and bolster French support for a UN resolution and, you know, dealing with Iraq, as well as French support in the war on terror. It would be one of those things that would push French politics in one direction rather than another. Because, of course, as you know, in France, there's been this huge bestseller, this 250,000 copies of this book sold, that says that September 11th was all carried out and by the U.S. government. I mean, really sort of paranoid conspiracy theories. So that would be a jolt to those. It's amazing, 250,000 people buying a book like that.
If there is chaos in the Gulf, do you think that we're best off diversifying our sources of oil? Or do you think there's one particular country that we should really go for?
You know, there is no great solution. These issues of energy security. We've lived with them for almost 30 years. We've lived with them actually much longer when you think back to the Second World War. So I think that, you know, the first principle is diversification because that enables you to absorb shocks and have alternatives. And, you know, if there was chaos in the Gulf, you're talking about a, you know, if you have a really nightmare scenario, that has huge implications.
Daniel Yergin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Daniel Yergin is the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Prize, The Epic Quest for Oil, Money, and Power. His PBS series, Commanding Heights, An Economic History of the 20th Century, is now out on video and DVD. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.